Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today I had with me on Zoom Hussein Kanji. Hussein is a general partner at Hoxton Ventures. And in today's episode, we talked about the future of Hoxton Ventures now that one of the partners is moving on, why Hoxton Ventures is an inclusive fund but looking to become more diverse in the investment team, what the problems are with tech businesses listing in the UK, and also what are the headwinds for emerging managers and indeed existing funds trying to raise from LPs in the current market. Let's get right into it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, via Zoom, I have with me Hussein Kanji for his second appearance on the Nothing Ventured podcast. Hussein is a general partner at Hoxton Ventures, a London-based VC firm investing at pre-seed and seed, focused on startups seeking to invent new market categories or transform large existing industries. For those of you that don't know Hussein, do check out the primer episode, which will have come out a few days before this one. But in the meantime, Hussein, great to have you here with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me again for a second time.
Amazing. Well, let's dive straight in. So we're going to get into a bit of detail. So Hoxton is well known for running a pretty lean team. However, earlier this year, the news broke that Rob Niaz, with whom you founded the firm back in 2013, has decided to move on. What does that mean for the fund today? And what does it mean for the future of Hoxton?
So Rob hasn't left just yet. And so Rob will basically not be joining our new fund and going off and doing something that we think is pretty interesting and exciting. And we'll talk about that in a second. But Rob stays on as a partner of 123. And the difference is between like other jobs and ventures, you're in a partnership and you're in a fund cycle. And so Rob will finish out the funds, and we are still very early days of Fund 2 and Fund 3, which are the newer funds. Fund 3 is like actually the newest fund. So Rob stays on as a full partner in those things, stays on the board, continues investing out of that fund. But I think increasingly, you know, and this is what happens, I think, as you get older and more established and you know, you just end up doing a lot more stuff, is I think Rob is convinced, and I think he's kind of right about this, is that there's a big opportunity in the UK about investing into the intersection of technology and bio. We've been doing it as a fund, and I think we've been doing it really well. And like I said, one of my best companies is a company in this space, but there's another way of doing it, which is actually having a lot more specialists around the table and a lot more of an organization that can help you interrogate this stuff. And if you're going to go more on the life sciences and less on the technology, I would argue you need more of that than less of that, because it's very hard to look at next generation research in like labs and therapeutics and like traditional life sciences without actually having an understanding of that stuff. Like, it's easy for us to spin up some computer model and look at the code. We kind of grok that intuitively because of the backgrounds that we're in, but like the stuff that the wet lab type stuff is a little bit harder. And then there's an open question inside of a firm. You meld these two together and you hire some research associates and some scientists and put them in the same office to help you do that. Or does that look and feel more like a different type of fund that is a much more specialized sector oriented fund? And I think the more conversations we had around the table, the more that feels like it's a specialist dedicated fund. So Rob is leaving, and Rob is very motivated, that's what he wants to do, like that, and that's the organization he wants to build, whereas we're still trying to be the benchmark of Europe at the seed stage versus at the early stage, although over time I think we end up going, which is a flat partnership, you know, no associates, no principals, like, you know, it's philosophically, these are two different models. And so the easiest way to reconcile them is to separate them. And that's what we're doing. So Rob stays on. And then in the next one, when we go off to do our benchmark type model for Hoxton 4, Rob goes off to do a more specialist oriented model. And he's incubating it inside of our office and becoming an LP in the fund. You know, it is this it's a separation, but it's about as gracious of a separation as you can possibly imagine, because I don't think these two things are necessarily competitive. And I think when they will be competitive, I see a company in the tech bio space, he sees the same company in the tech bio space, you know, hopefully you'll find a way to both do it together, right? Where there actually may be a reason to have a generalist fund like ourselves and the specialist fund that has like the depth on his side, as opposed to like maybe doing it with like someone else who comes out of a life sciences background, which is historically what we've done in Austin. So like you have a friend leave that's a specialist kind of doing it. And then on our side, you know, we're kind of down a person in the future, but we've been building and growing this organization as well. So we hired another person last year, which is, or beginning of this year, which is Peyton Dobbs, who spent 17 years at Google. We went to business school together, so we've known each other for a long time now, like, you know, 17 years. He's running the hardware business in Google for what was Nest, and then Nest got merged in with Fitbit and all the Pixel and all the hardware devices. Before that, he was doing ad sales. He used to work for Sheryl, and Sheryl was in charge of Google's ad business before she went to Meta. Super well connected. I remember like we were having an internal meeting one day, the same day that Google released Bard, and he was back and forth with the CEO of Sundar of Google. So like very well connected within the Google ecosystem. I think a good addition, and we're probably going to hire another one or two people kind of in that same mold, like people come out of the technology industry who've then been investing. And like, you know, if you're trying to build a firm that's kind of sort of like a benchmark, or hopefully it's like a Sequoia, may not be that today, but it's kind of, you know, you've got to staff it with really, really great people. And so that's what we're trying to do. And then the mission of the firm has always been new category creation and figure out how to link companies in Europe to the US market. So those two things I think will be intrinsic to whoever we hire. They'll need to have the Rolodexes in the US, and they'll need to be able to pick and spot the next generation of companies. And I think the firm will probably grow, you know, as a guess, like 5 to 7 people over time versus the historic two people, which is what we were for the longest time.
Well, let's talk about that kind of people growth for a second. So Hoxton has also caught some flack recently, a little bit underhanded, I think, in some articles for being like an all-male investment team. So what's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very fair comment. So on the investing side, so put aside the partnership, like on our side, and I think we should be responsible and equally responsible for both, right? But on the investing side, I was at a dinner with a very senior person at McKinsey and found this forum and kind of thrown this fine dinner for us, and they gave us some of the stats, and my table shared some of the stats with me. Best in class right now in private equity, which is arguably a little bit more ahead of the curve on diversity than venture has been, because they have had more pressure and they're bigger and they're just more cognizant of these things. These business growth funds has a portfolio that's 24% female led. That's like best in class. Average is 2%, sometimes 1%. It's really quite bad. Hoxton is 24%. Now we're embarrassed by this 24%, because like when you say 24%, it's not 50%, right? So like you're clearly falling like well shy of where it should be just naturally. But we're best in class. Now we have challenged most of our peers in the venture industry to put these darn stats on their website or publish them. People spend a lot of time and energy talking about diversity, talking about how they're making their pipeline much better, talking about how their partnerships are more diverse, but they don't publish a darn thing of like where their money goes and who they're investing into. We are not happy with our numbers, and we put the numbers up and they change. Like every time there's a new investment, you'll see the single, like we'll go from 24 to 22 or 24 to 21. Like if we're investing in more men, we'll hopefully go to 24 to 28 if we're investing in more females. But there, it's a live counter on our website. And I would encourage everyone to do that. But that doesn't excuse the partnership from also being diverse. But I would say on the investing side, we are above average. We think it's just above average. We're told that it's better than above average. We still don't think it's good enough. It should really be 50-50, and that's what we'll kind of aim for. And then on the partnership side, look, when you're a two-person organization, you know, if you and your co-founder, like we went from two to three, and we hired a COO, and we had a female candidate. We had three candidates in the pool. We picked, so we gave three males. We just hired Peyton, so now and Charles, so it's like four and five males. It's getting kind of sort of embarrassing. If we keep up this trend, it's still small numbers, but if we keep this stuff up, it's going to actually be harder for a woman to join the firm.
Sure.
Because if they're like seven men and you're the first female, that's a lot harder when there's three men and you're the first female. So we're very cognizant of it, but it is hard to find really good partners who have the links to California, who are good board members, who are capable investors, and are willing to leave the excellent firms that they're at. Like, we're not going to hire like Sonali out of Accel, who's like a great, well, we're not going to hire Laurel Bowden out of 83 North, like into Hoxton. So we've got to go figure out who those equivalents are that are up and coming. And we got an active search going. And like, I just came off of a search call maybe an hour ago. Like, there is a lot, like we're putting a lot of pressure on this to try and find it, but it is genuinely hard to find. So we are doing and we've put the call out like publicly. So if you're a woman and you qualify like to be a venture person, like you have these core skill sets, which to us are really simple. It's like board experience, investment experience, and Rolodex in California. Please come find me. Like my email is hk@hoxton.vc. Super easy. My LinkedIn, very public. Tweet me, whatever. I will happily take a meeting. Like, because I'm like, we're quite serious about this. We'll look like broad and wide to be able to go figure this stuff out. But I feel like it is a harder bar in Europe than it is in the US because there are not that many people who have the prerequisites. And our prerequisites, I think, make a lot of sense for a venture firm like us. And then the one thing that we can't slide on as much is quality. So like, we need to find women who are capable, and there are a lot of them in the U.S. Getting them over to the U.K. is a high bar, right? Because they're usually super successful in the U.S. and they're on the trajectory of becoming super successful. Relocating to a brand new country and kind of starting from scratch is a tall ask.
Well, I think the other thing also is that because you are a lean firm, right? Like you don't have associates, you don't have investment managers, you don't have venture partners, you don't have kind of that infrastructure that you could, potentially sort of, build that career path for someone. So essentially you are looking for a straight up partner, right? You're not looking for an associate that can build to partnership level. And do you think that that's something that will kind of remain a core principle of the fund, just the flat partnership structure and that's it?
Yeah, and we're big believers in this like equal carry model. And if we ever adjust it, the only reason why, and we were not ready to adjust it yet. So like if we find another one or two people, then maybe we home grow the person after that. But for the time being, like we kind of need everyone to hit the ground running. We just don't have the time and bandwidth to train the person up into the role because we like that would take time away from me spending time with the companies. And we just don't have enough of a bench of partners or senior enough as a small firm that's historically been really lean. So we can't make the investment. There's an investment that is required on the firm into training a younger person up. And we will never hire a younger person simply to have a younger person on the team. If we hire a younger person, it's because we see a spark. And then we're going to apprentice them for 1 or 2 years and turn them into a partner that's an equal carry partner. So the bar is really high. We probably will end up growing people up inside this model because that's the best way to kind of build the talent pool because you're home growing your own base. But it's not, we're going to hire five associates and the best of the brightest will survive and the other four or the other three will kind of get shown the door. Like, we're just like, if we do it, we're going to invest very heavily in the person's career to grow them up as quickly as possible and apprentice them on the things that need to be apprenticed on. Like I was talking to a friend of mine who's a principal at another fund, and I was shocked that he had no board experience. I was like, you see these problems at the board, and then you have to be very literate in terms of like when to speak up, how to solve the problem, how to have perspective on what the problem, like how to, like you, and you can't do that by kind of guessing. You kind of have to have seen the movie before. But most firms don't put people in those positions. If we hire a younger person, we will do that. And to be fair, like the one thing Axel gave me that was like incredible, like from the time I joined, which is when I was still a business school student. Like, I was not officially full-time at Accel, but like from pretty much month one, I took board seats. And they weren't my board seats, and I was shadowing someone, but from like day one of the firm had that much trust to say, you're turning up to these boards, you're going to learn the job by watching other people do the job, and we will expose you to everything that happens inside the firm. Meetings will not be closed to you because it's the only way to learn the business. Most firms don't do that with younger people. So if we do hire a younger person, it'll be to do that, but with a goal, like in a year or two, to make them a full-on GP. But we're not ready to do that because I don't think we have the bench to be able to invest the time and energy it takes to actually do that effort. That would basically take like 20-30% of my time. And I don't have 20-30% of my time to give to do that just yet.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, one of the most important kind of roles of a board member is the fiduciary responsibility, which is something that realistically, you know, you can't be taught as such. It's something that, you know, comes to you over time, seeing all of these things play out at board level, understanding when is the right time to push for, you know, a sale versus growth versus doing something completely different. And, you know, especially in the current market, I assume there's a lot of kind of those sort of conversations happening as well, right? Because, you know, because things have not been as easy as they maybe were 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, and the good news about these kinds of markets, when they're choppier, is it's much easier to be trained into becoming like an excellent board member because you actually see a wider spectrum of like stuff. And the stuff is usually like the mess, right? Like you learn more by being exposed to more mess versus less mess. Yeah. You want no mess at all in your companies, but you learn by seeing the mess and then seeing how people respond to the mess. And some people respond to it well. Some people aggravate the situation and make it much worse. There are times when you actually have to like speak up and force something. There are other times where you have to be a little bit more passive. All of this stuff is nuanced. It's more of an art than a science. And it requires kind of being around the room. You can't really learn it secondhand. And one of the reasons I think why the big venture funds, and I'm a big believer in like the big US established venture funds, is like they have institutional history that other funds don't have. So like you get to talk to people in the firm who may be like 20 years out of date in terms of new investments, but they're definitely not 20 years out of date and seeing like weird stuff happen and weird, like exotic situations kind of crop up, and they will have perspective. The perspective may be different than the perspective that you need, but it is useful to have some perspective to know how to do this stuff. Like there is real value in institutional history as a venture firm, particularly when things get like weird. Like having lived through the dot-com bubble and figure out how to reconcile your portfolios and get them funded. And you know, there is, that has applicable lessons to say. It may not be one-to-one lessons. You're not going to run exactly the same playbooks, but having informed discussions around that is useful. And so I think there's a lot of merit towards those kinds of firms that are more established whenever markets kind of get weird. And the weird thing is the last 10 years, almost everyone who's been younger has seen nothing but stuff go up into the right. You train yourself to find the company that gets the hot round, the Tango gets funded by Tiger or by SoftBank. You know, I would argue that a different skill set and a different kind of training than someone who's kind of lived through choppy waters that can like figure out how to go into the trenches with a founder and turn around the business to go from loss making to profit making, which is like hard work, like and do it in a way that doesn't stress out the founder. Because I almost guarantee you, if it's like a good founder, they're 10 times more stressed than you are as an investor on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, let's talk about some of the those headwinds, right? So we often talk about on the podcast the difficulties that founders have in raising funds in the current market, right? But what about VCs, right? I've spoken to some emerging VCs who are seeing headwinds closing their first fund. Like, from your perspective, how challenging is the LP environment at the moment? And for a fund like Hoxton, which is already on fund three, does it get easier or is everyone essentially in the same boat?
I think the worry is whenever markets change, asset allocators, so like think of like a classic university endowment that allocates to venture, right? If you're managing a $20 billion endowment and the endowment has gone from 20 to 19 billion, you've lost a billion of value, and you're allocating as a percentage to venture. So your percentage now comes down. And it becomes, you know, and then on top of that, if you're in an industry where it has historically been distributing capital back to investors, and the investors have more money to deploy, right? Because there's money kind of coming in that they weren't expecting. You got $1 billion of Twitter distributions, right? You know, when Twitter went public, now you've got to figure out how to do that money to put it to work. You know, you'll go longer venture, right? You'll do more managers versus less managers. But now you're in a world where nothing is coming back in, and the overall value has come down because the stock market is corrected. And then you're over indexed on venture, you will cut back. You won't cut back to zero. What you just do is you'll be a lot more selective about who it is that you want to invest into. And then that compounds with the fact that everyone comes to you for money again, right? Because if they run out of money, so you have your whole list of people coming and knocking on you at a time where you have to be more selective about who you want to give money to. It's a harder, this is what makes it a harder fundraising environment. And anyone who lived through, you know, 2001 or 2002 would have seen this kind of firsthand on the LP side, because that's exactly the same kind of dynamic. It is less pronounced than 01, 02. And it is easier today. And I think part of it is at 01, 02, a lot of people walked away from technology thinking we were sold this kind of bill of goods. It's never going to be real. I think even now, as the markets have corrected and SaaS multiples have come down from like 21x to like 6x, yeah, like it's a material change. But it would be hard pressed to find someone who doesn't see that generative AI is going to change things. Like, so it's hard to be a techno skeptic in 2023. You could have been a techno skeptic in 2002 saying, I just got sold this .com BS. Like, you know, there's nothing of substance here. It's hard to be as much of a skeptic today. And then I think a lot of LPs learned if they pulled out of those funds in 2001, 2002, you know, the Axel 2005 fund, which is the one that has Facebook in it, did incredibly well. And if you pulled out and then you missed that fund, you know, you have to blend your returns across funds and across cycles. And all of a sudden you are now locked out of the new, like you can't pick and choose. I don't want to be in this one. And then you get locked out and then you miss the next one that kind of does really well. The people, there's a little bit of like a fear of missing out on the LP side. It's like, what happens if like there's a super definitive Gen AI company that ends up sitting in someone's fund, you know, and you pulled out of the last fund and you're not allowed access back in. So people are more cognizant of this. You know, weirdly enough, we're still seeing early stage, like emerging managers still get funded. So I think the market is actually not as bad as you might think. There are still emerging managers announcing. I think it is harder. Like, I think if you're an emerging manager who started in 2021 and you saw everyone and your data set was like your peers in 2019 and 2020 and 2021 all building their funds, and you're like, oh my God, 2022 and 2023 is so hard. You know, you might be a little bit biased only because of recent history. Like, 2023 is not as bad of a year for emerging managers as like 2010 was. Is a lot better. So like, it just depends on perspective. It's harder than 2021, but it's not that hard in the grand scheme of things. But you know, in 2021, I would argue almost every emerging manager would get funded in, yeah, 2023. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's going to be the case in 2024. Like, you know, timing is a lot of business, and sometimes you have to be in the right place with the right plan ahead of when the market's kind of correct.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, as someone who raised the fund, you know, which took 39 months to close, as you said, you know, during the primer episode, ultimately, a lot of this is just staying power, right? And just continuing to kind of grind out the conversations. And, you know, I read on Twitter today, I can't remember who it was that posted it, you know, they had an LP write the last check into their fund after 12 months because they've been tracking the progress, seeing how they're, you know, how they've been performing, and, you know, had basically, you know, decided at that stage that it made sense to actually deploy. So, you know, I think there are two things that come out. So one, as you say, the asset allocation kind of strategy. So not only, you know, so essentially what you're saying is to some extent, some LPs will be overweight sort of venture in their overall asset allocation because one, they've had obviously paper markups, but then two, their you know, overall portfolio has dropped, and therefore as a percentage of the overall portfolio, they're overexposed. And then secondly, you know, it when everyone is coming to the table, you know, you've got to make those harder choices. But I completely agree in the sense that you know, that techno optimism that you talked about, like, it's very much there. Obviously, there's a lot of noise, especially in the generative AI space, but, you know, essentially that noise will die down and we'll see some incredible businesses that come out of this period, right?
Yeah, that's my take, right? And so I think people still see that. And so people are still funding the funds. I mean, it's not dry like it was in 01 or 02. So it is materially better. But yeah, again, it's all perspective, right? In terms of like what you're comparing, are you comparing against, like, is it recent bias phenomena or is it like a little bit longer perspective? And then, you know, I say this 39 months. I think anyone who's been raising an emerging manager fund in the last like 3-4 years, like, you'd be flabbergasted that a fund took 39. Like, there were no funds that took 39 months to go raise in the last like 2-3 years. Like, you know, it was, you know, 12 months felt long, 18 months felt like really long, 24 months was like ridiculously long. Like 39 months is like not even like remotely like people didn't experience any of that, right? So you might have more of those now, but yeah, I still think it's a reasonably healthy market.
Yeah. And let's talk about kind of the other side, right? So you've been really vocal about problems that European kind of tech high growth companies have exiting into the local capital markets. And you've had a number of Twitter arguments with one of our previous guests as well, Neil Shah, on the topic. Neil's with the London Stock Exchange Group. You know, what are the key issues? Like, if you actually boil it down, what are the key issues that are, you know, deterrents? And what needs to change so that more businesses choose to list locally rather than heading out to the US? Or do you feel that actually that's just the way, you know, that's the way it is, and actually there's no issues with businesses listing in the US versus Europe or the UK?
Yeah, I mean, so Neil and I have had these arguments, and I think the lawyers in the city have decided, like, I am the anti-LSB person because of my very active Twitter, like, on like, why the LSB. And to be fair, it has nothing to do with the LSE. I think the LSE is a perfectly fine exchange. And I think the LSE is actually far more sophisticated than a lot of the US, like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. Like, they don't have a trading floor, right? It's all digital. They're a super big believer in technology. The problem is not the LSE. The problem is the people who trade on the LSE. And it is a dividend. Like, they want dividends and yields, not high growth. Like, it's a group of basically value investors versus growth investors. And, you know, they would much rather buy the Russian oligarch mining company in like than they would like the high growth tech company. And I just don't know how you change the participants on an exchange, you know, to think a little bit different. And then the analyst coverage that goes hand in hand with this is weak in the UK. Like, and that's because I don't think, and this is a chicken and egg problem. If there are not enough tech companies, then the coverage of the tech companies is weak because the person who's covering them is doing all kinds of stuff. Like, whereas in the US, if you're a cybersecurity company, there'll be a cybersecurity person who is covering your stocks who can speak very intelligently about the difference between Cloudflare and CrowdStrike and Darktrace. Whereas in the UK, you'll get lumped in with like all software companies or all tech companies. And so the research coverage is not going to be as good enough. It's not going to be on par with the US coverage. So you have these like systemic type things in the market where it's hard to figure out how to undo them. And all the stuff that people are doing is like, I feel like they're focusing on like narrow niche things. Like, yes, you can change the dual class listing stuff. Yes, you can have like, you know, you can give more rights to the founders. Like, yes, you can do all these kinds of things, but like,
it doesn't change the market participants, right?
Yeah, it doesn't change the market. And how do you, I mean, I don't know how you tell like a bunch of market participants you're being old fuddy-duddies and you're the wrong generation. Like, this is an impossible thing to do. So I am of the view is like, why even, like, it would be great to fix, but if you can't fix it, why bother? Like, why not just list in a place that where the coverage is good, the institutional investors are good. You know, if you're historically, if you're a UK pension fund manager, you could not buy shares in the US. Like, they were these national guidelines. Like, that was true in the 80s, and it's not true in 2023. So you type in like a few more digits into your Bloomberg terminal, like, problem solved. Like, you know, like, Russian oligarchs can list their businesses on the London Stock Exchange and tech companies can list their businesses on NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange. Like, and everyone's happy, like mining company, LSE, tech company, New York Stock Exchange. Neil does not want to hear this, but like a mining company would get a much better valuation in Canada or the UK than it would on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
That's why it goes there. And a tech company would get a much better valuation on the New York Stock Exchange. So that's why it should go there. And until you fix it, like, why should you adjust? Now, there's a big national pride thing, which like I have no stake in the game here. Like I'm like the financial returns guy, right? Like I'm not even a UK citizen. So like I don't have to worry about this problem. I just have to worry about where the best place is. But I think there are a lot of people who worry about the national identity around this stuff and national pride around this stuff. And I think rightfully so, like, but like it's also a problem I don't think is that big of, it's not that big of a problem at the end of the day.
Yeah, ultimately, if your role as an investor is to make a return on you know, on the assets that you have invested in, and for the founders to make a return on what they've built, then they're just going to go where they're going to get the best opportunity. And that's how the market works, right? Like, I mean, that's the whole point of the market.
And in the last like 3-4 years, we ran a whole bunch of experiments on the LSE to put like really good companies like on the LSE. And like, guess what? It was disappointing. Like, so like, you know, why should we run that experiment again? Like, let's go put it in like, let's like TransferWise is a perfectly fine company, right? And I would argue is undervalued on the LSE versus if it was on NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. So now that we have that data point, like we tried, we gave it like a good try. It didn't work. Let's default to like listing it in the US until like they can show us that it like it's a better exchange. And then not our job to go figure that out. It's like it's the governments and the LSEs and the market participants to figure it out. And the ironic thing is some of these guys or market participants are perfectly happy buying the shares on the New York Stock Exchange and paying the premiums. But when it's a company on the LSE, they want it to look different. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how to fix that. Like, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a couple of, just as we draw to a close, like there's a couple of parallels there. So I think about this a lot also in terms of kind of the very early stage investing. So you think about angels in the UK, a lot of, especially outside of London, a lot of that capital sits with, you know, in your words, old fuddy-duddies. So like it's the lawyers, the accountants, the kind of real estate guys or the people that bought a lot of property in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, et cetera. And they don't quote unquote get tech. It's why like on Dragon's Den, you also see these, you know, ludicrous valuations being given, you know, 10% for 100 grand or whatever, really undervaluing the businesses. And that there is this kind of thing of like getting that cheap deal.
By the way, I think this Dragon's Den example like captures it, right? Like if you watch Shark Tank, which is the Dragon's Den equivalent in the US, there is a material difference between the way, I mean, you know, they can also be mean to the entrepreneurs, but I think Dragon's Den takes like special pride in being like really like putting the entrepreneurs down. Whereas like Shark Tank, they actually write the checks often, like more so than you would think. And these are two cultural differences between the two places. When you can make this feel more like Shark Tank, then we should do more stuff here. Like, and that's like when the LSE feels more like New York Stock Exchange, like there should be more listings in the LSE. But until that happens, like why bother?
I mean, the interesting thing as well is, I mean, there was a recent article, I think it was the Evening Standard, and I had a bit of an exchange with the author because, you know, it was a list of 100, you know, the 100 top tech entrepreneurs in the UK. And I kind of looked through the list and I was like, okay, there's a fair number here that I wouldn't consider technology businesses, right? So, you know, had Gymshark on there, which is, you know, Gymshark has been an incredible success story for sure, but it is an apparel business rather than a tech business as such, right? And I think there's also just this kind of, you know, disconnect between how we think about what technology businesses should look like and what they actually are here in the UK. But look, Hussein, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast again. Really thankful for your time. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? You mentioned it already. You're obviously on LinkedIn, you're on Twitter, but where's the best place to get a hold of you?
If you just go to hoxton.bc and go to my page or my profile, like all the links are there. But like Twitter is probably easy, which is at hkanji, first initial, last name. Email is really easy. It's just hk@hoxton.bc. And then LinkedIn is like, I don't know what the LinkedIn URL is for me. I think it's Hussein Kanji, or I don't know. I think it may be H Kanji or Hussein Kanji, but the link to LinkedIn is on the Hoxton website.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.